You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio. Welcome to this edition of Echotones. I'm Joy LaClaire. Our guest today on Echotones is Bozeman author Teresa Nichols Schuster, whose first novel, We Are the Warriors, was named a 2015 USA Regional Excellence Book Award finalist in Young Adult Fiction, Western Region. Teresa grew up exploring the rivers, hills, and mountains outside Billings, Montana. She shares her passion about the many facets of nature through her writing, where she also expresses her belief in the power of each person to learn and adapt, as well as the significance of each one's unique story, and that history comes alive with the accounts of real people, their joys, griefs, loves, losses, and triumphs. After 3 decades of family life and work in Wolf Point on the Fort Peck, Sioux, and Assiniboine Reservation in northeast Montana, she moved to Bozeman, where she continues to enjoy the gifts of the outdoors, family, friends, and a little clay work on the side. Her latest book, Brittle Silver, was featured in a review in the Montana Quarterly. It's a time travel adventure set in contemporary Phillipsburg and the historic mining town of 1893 Granite, Montana, high in the Flint Creek Mountains. We spoke with Teresa Nichols Schuster at the Beyond the Deep End studio on July 18th, 2023. Welcome to Echotones, Teresa Nichols Schuster.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and sharing this visit with you about some of my writing and life experiences.
Teresa, you grew up outside of Billings, Montana, and you come from several generations of Montanans, including your paternal grandmother, who was a homesteader. Tell us a bit about your family's history and growing up where you did.
Well, it's interesting. My grandmother, as a single woman in the early 1900s, homesteaded between Jordan and Brockway, which people out there kind of say Miles City might be a little bit closer, big town, is in the middle of nowhere. So it's kind of interesting to think that she came from Canada as a single woman and then met my grandfather, who also was homesteading out there. She'd hired him to plow her land, and that's how they met. And she eventually had 4 children out there in the middle of somewhat nowhere. And actually, one of the children got bit by a rattlesnake out there, and she was by herself because her husband had gone off to several days travel, I guess, probably by horseback to do some work or deliver mail or something. So anyways, my Uncle Pat survived that, thankfully, and then she lost her 4th or 5th child out there, and the doctor said that the child probably could have been saved if she would have been near a bigger city, so or bigger town. So she moved to Otter, Montana with her husband, which is another southeastern Montana, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but anyways, so the family did freight and mail and post office business in southeastern Montana. And my dad graduated from St. Labre, which was called St. Labre Indian School at the time. And even though he wasn't tribal, it was an integrated school at the time, boarding school. And so in the 1930s, he graduated from there. So there's been a real love of the southeastern Montana and the rolling hills and plains and the isolated mountains out there. And I grew up in Billings, right against the Yellowstone River. So I spent many days wandering the riverbanks and climbing around the river. And then my dad loved to be out in the countryside when he had a day off from work. So I spent a lot of time outside and enjoyed the country a lot.
When did your grandmother immigrate to Montana from Canada, approximately?
I think she was like 19, I'm thinking my dad was born in 1918, so it would have been about 1915 or something like that. And she, as a 19-year-old, was helping a family up in Canada. And the wife had gotten sick, and then it turned out the father was a postmaster, and he got smallpox, I guess, maybe from the mail, because it had mostly been eradicated by then. So anyway, she at 19 years old was taking care of this whole family and helping run the post office, and then eventually came down from Canada to homestead. So she still had family up in Canada. I think one of her brothers served in World War II from Canada. And my dad did from Montana. Of course, he was in North Africa for a couple of years within the World War II. For probably 4 years, he spent his early years there, so that was very formative for him. But they kept turkeys out there in southeast Montana, kept the freight running summer, winter, whatever. And I guess
that would be by train, the freight?
The freight was by, I think it started out with horses and wagons, and then eventually came to be in the otter country was more cars and
trucks.
My dad was a truck driver, so he ended up driving freight when he was there helping him out. So
before we get to your writing two novels, the young adult book We Are the Warriors that came out in book form in 2015, and it was named 2015 USA Regional Excellence Book Award finalist in young adult fiction. Congratulations on that for
Thank
the
you.
West region.
Thank you.
And then your current novel that came out in 2022, Brittle Silver. Let's talk about your academic career. You have 3 university degrees, a BS from Montana State University in Agricultural Land Resources, and is that MSU Billings or Bozeman?
MSU Bozeman.
Bozeman, okay.
Yeah.
You have a master's in theological studies from the Berkeley, California Graduate Theological Union, and then, as if that isn't enough, you have a master's in education from Montana State University, Billings.
Yeah, there's an old saying, I never know what I want to be, you know. It's kind of like I've just never quite settled on where I'm going, I guess. But enjoyed them all for different reasons. I was in botany, actually was in K through 12 PE here in Bozeman, Montana. And then I ended up switching into botany. And then I heard they had a landscape horticulture degree, and I thought, well, that sounds like fun. I wasn't very practical at the time, I don't think. But it seemed like a neat way to go, and I wanted to live in Montana, so it's kind of odd because Montana has a very short summer. So it probably wasn't the most practical decision, and then I had to switch to agricultural land resources. So I took a lot of the ag courses here in Bozeman at MSU and ended up getting my landscape horticulture degree, and then had a real ecumenical feel about my religious background. I was pretty open-minded, but yet was raised in the Catholic tradition. So things were kind of progressive at that time. You know, there was a really progressive outward movement of being really open here at the university parish at the time. And after Vatican II, thought things were going to change. And so ended up going to study theology. And I wanted to go to an ecumenical place. It was either going to be Boston or Berkeley was my two choices. Finally decided on Berkeley. And had a wonderful education there, top-notch graduate theological education, and took courses from the Baptist School, from the Pacific School of Religion, from the Franciscans, from the Jesuits. Had some courses I took in the Franciscans, of course. Ended up being hired up in Wolf Point to work as a parish minister back, oh gosh, it's been 1980s, so it's been a long time ago. And back then, I was allowed to do much more than most Catholic women can do in the church right now. So I went up and worked at Wolf Point on the Fort Peck Sioux and Assiniboine Reservation for about 11 years, met my husband up there and remained up there for 30 years. So anyways, meanwhile, then I had to retrain myself once the Catholic fit as a parish minister wasn't going to work because they started taking away what women were allowed to do. So some of the things that I was doing, I was no longer allowed to do. So I was doing wake services, I was doing leading Eucharistic services, preaching, doing a lot of other things, and they started taking that away from me. And it was just like, well, this isn't fitting, this isn't working.
Let me just ask you, how were these things, what was the process of these things being taken away? Did you like get a letter from the bishop or?
As priests change, they have pretty much a lot of control over what goes on in a parish. So you have a certain priest that hires you, you work with them for 4 years, a different one comes in, then they have their mindset and how they're doing things, and then another one comes in. And so as they come in, they're able to form that and use the kind of church rules and whatever in whatever form they want to. Some follow them strictly, some follow them lightly, some interpret them in different ways. And so it becomes very much a prerogative of that parish priest to make decisions about what happens in that. And the parish councils in Catholic churches are only advisory. They do not make decisions. And there is not a democratic process.
I guess what I was wondering was, as parish priests change, so do popes. Mm-hmm. And Pope John the 23rd was very liberal
by, you know, historic standards. But then when John Paul II came in, I had the impression things started to tighten up. So I guess what I was asking, did you have a sense that it was a papal change that came down the hierarchy to your parish in Wolf Point, or was it more the individual inclinations of the parish priest?
I think at the time it's individual. There are trends. There are kind of big shifts that go slowly, but they trickle down. Obviously, the bishops within each, there's two bishops in Montana, east and west, and so they have a lot of influence on what happens. And there have been parish priests that buck against what the bishop wants them to do. So you get some of these things going on back and forth. So there's always the bigger trends, but then there's just a lot of local involvement as to how things are interpreted and how they're played out. And there was a real concerted pressure to not let women preach in the last 10, 15, 20 years. I can't remember when that really started, but that women couldn't be at the pulpit, and a lot of pressure from the bishops putting pressure on the parish priests not to let that happen. So obviously some people agreed with that, some didn't. So.
And before that change, you had been preaching from the pulpit?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, it certainly resonates with our current time with the recent decisions by the Southern Baptist Church. Also, there had been women preaching, and now that's no longer allowed.
Yeah, as those trends go, it's difficult to see, and it's just hard to imagine that 40 years ago I did more than women in the Catholic Church can do right now.
So you met your husband up there. Your husband recently passed away.
2 years ago, yes.
Yeah, my condolences.
Thank
for
you,
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was quite the person. Listeners should know that the latest census, fewer than 3,000 people live in this entire county.
Might be a few more than that. It's got to be closer to 10. 10,000 in the whole county.
Or maybe it's just Wolf Point.
3,000 in Wolf Point.
Wolf Point. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
3,000.
All right, so big population in Roosevelt County.
Right.
How would you describe that for listeners in terms of geography, where that is?
Okay, so I just drove up to Wolf Point for the 100th Stampede. That's a big rodeo, wild horse stampede. So it's a big time in town. Oldest rodeo in Montana,
yeah.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they celebrated their 100 years. You drive in the rolling hills and the rolling plains out there, and it's like 50 miles to every town, so there's not much. And people say driving with no car in front of you and no car behind you. So try to imagine that. In most of our areas of the country, that doesn't happen. You cross the Missouri River when you come into Wolf Point area. And like I say, there's the rolling hills, the prairie, a lot of farming and ranching in the area, wide open spaces. Wolf Point is on the Fort Peck Sioux and Assiniboine Reservation. And as I've mentioned, I think in We Are the Warriors, a little note that a lot of these reservations were open to homesteading at a certain point in time in the 20s. I don't know all the exactness of it, but allotments were given to individual tribal members and family members, and if those weren't used, then they allowed it for homesteading. Mixed opinions on all that whole thing. But anyways, that is what happened. So Wolf Point is kind of a mix of tribal and non-tribal. And up there, spending 30 years in Wolf Point, the word people would use talking to each other is either tribal or non-tribal. And oftentimes people would refer to themselves as Indians themselves. That was the word they used. So Native Americans, now Indigenous, is getting to be more the proper way to speak. But typically, if you were, like, I would say I'm non-tribal. That's what I would say on the reservation. This person is tribal. And that was kind of how we'd speak up there. But my husband was very proud of his Wolf Point roots. He was born in Glasgow, which is about 50 miles away from Wolf Point. He was very proud of Wolf Point and proud of the community and what it was able to do. And Fort Peck Sioux and Assiniboine tribes have been known to be one of the more progressive tribes within the United States and in Western U.S., and they've done some very groundbreaking thing. There's been some groundbreaking women and men who have been legislators and involved in different legislative pursuits and gone back to Washington, D.C. to see some of the things happen that they'd like to see. It's a diverse community. It's ranchers and farmers and local business people and people involved in the tribal court systems, the tribal college up there. There's community college up there. So it's a small but interesting area.
Your husband, Jerry, he's an attorney, right?
He was an attorney, yes.
So in his obituary, it's described as an attorney wearing many hats.
Definitely.
What were some of those hats?
Well, he always used to come back from his meetings saying, people say you're not supposed to be wearing all these different hats. They don't cross, he said. But out here in northeast Montana, you're 300 miles from the nearest city. So Billings, 320 miles. Great Falls, 300 miles away. Is in this process, when he got up there as a young attorney, he got asked to be the city attorney. So, okay, he did that. Well, then his partner was a county attorney, so he got asked to be the deputy county attorney. So he did that. Then he had a private practice. Well, then he got asked to be the magistrate because with the reservation and some of the federal laws that are entailed that cross over with the sovereignty of the tribal people, and then also the CM Wildlife Refuge was down the road a ways, which would involve federal jurisdiction. So he got asked to be a part-time magistrate, which was a real small part of his job, but he did enjoy doing that. And then the tribal people needed an attorney on their tribal appellate court. So for many years, he served on the tribal appellate court for the Sioux and Assiniboine tribal courts, and he was well respected and liked for that position. And then he had his private practice where he did leases and for farmers and ranchers and did wills and probate work. And so he was kind of like, if they all showed up at the same day, he was just, his eyes were just a blur. He was just exhausted. But it was quite a challenging time raising kids, trying to make a living, because all of it was just a little bit here, a little bit there. And he was what I would call one of your last old-time attorneys, where you could just come sit in, talk with him. He didn't charge any money. You could call and ask him a question or two. No big deal. And he also had a lot of integrity. And if people were trying to do things he didn't think had proper law or integrity, he'd say, please leave, But he did like his work. It wore him out sometimes, but he liked it.
Now, you mentioned raising a family. So you had how many children?
Well, when I married my husband, he had three children, and then we had two more. So we had five children up north. And one point in time, the oldest was 17 years older than the youngest. So I had a new baby and a senior in high school at the same time. And I was working 30 hours a week and feeling pretty exhausted half the time. But it was busy. But I enjoyed the kids' schooling and what they were doing. And it was always fun to be a part of that.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, did you use your master's in education?
I ended up, after I was in church work for about 11 years and then quit that, and then ended up trying to find, there's not a lot of choices of what you're going to do for work up there. So I ended up substitute teaching. I ended up being a director of a tourism group, which is a kind of a small regional area up there. And then ended up deciding to work with health promotion and knew I needed to get some training to be able to be some kind of certification for that. So I went to MSU Billings in the summer times to pick up my education degree with an emphasis in health promotion. And then I opened up my own business, and I worked with the counties and the tribes with different programs to help the health and wellness. So I was working like the Welfare to Work program. I was working with tobacco prevention, HIV prevention, and other county of health promotion and local things for the three county area up there.
You were riding the circuit.
Yeah. And some of like one year we had like 10 meetings in Helena, and it's 400 miles from Wolf Point to Helena. And I was like, I was spending half my time going to meetings. So we kind of got it trimmed down, and the state came out our way a little bit more often. So we didn't have to always be on the road for these meetings, but it was good to work with a lot of different people up there. The county commissioners were very supportive. The county health department was really supportive, and the Sheridan and Daniels County too worked with them. And a lot of the newspapers, the tribal paper and the local, used to be the Herald News, now it's the Independent Plains, was very supportive for a lot of the health work and the health promotion work that was done up there. So that was kind of nice.
That was in some ways a different era in terms of health communication. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts or feelings about how public health people were sometimes treated during the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, I was very aware of it, because if I would have been in Wolf Point still, I know I would have been working in that whole field, because if there's no way I would not have been pulled into that whole thing if I would have still been up there, because I left in 2013 and closed my health promotion business at that time. I felt bad for the way the health people were treated and the animosity that came out. And unfortunately, there were so many, we all felt the fears and the unknowns, I think, of the pandemic. And I still remember the first 2 weeks we were kind of isolated. And I had a husband who had lung cancer at this time. So I was very, very aware and very concerned about his health, and knew that if he got COVID, he probably would not survive it. He did not die from COVID. He did not get COVID. But knowing the task that is put on our health people. And over the years, I mean, you even look back of like my grandmother talking about smallpox, the issues that went on for keeping people safe from viruses and diseases that will decimate populations is a very serious, difficult thing to be involved in. And we had some things obviously up north that were part of our health challenges too. So I think it's been difficult to see how we haven't always been kind to people that think differently than we do. And there's been a lot of animosity that's been created and generated that has been fueled. And I don't think some of that fueling has been necessary, and that we needed to be more attentive to other people's needs, not just what we want sometimes. And I found it interesting, just a little aside, but when I was working health promotion years ago, tobacco prevention, the Clean Indoor Air Act was not created in Montana by the health departments. It was created by the legislature, and they were actually one step ahead. And I don't remember quite why that happened in the whole process, but all of a sudden, as a person working for the health department, we then had to enforce a Clean Indoor Air Act that did not come out of the health department. I mean, we were working our way that direction for sure, but they like jumped in front of it. And I can't remember if there was reasons, was because of the insurance concerns if people got sick from secondhand smoke, etc. But I find it interesting because in that instance, the legislature jumped ahead to protect people and the health departments had to come in behind and actually then support this. And I wasn't a very good tobacco prevention police person. It wasn't my favorite part of my job. And it was a difficult thing to do at that time.
When did you begin writing, Teresa?
I have journals from when I was 20, so I probably have about 40 plus years of journals. So it's kind of been something I've enjoyed doing in journaling. And then somewhere up in Wolf Point, maybe 25 years ago or so, I was like, what can I do that I really don't know that I could really accomplish? And I said, well, how about write a book? So I did work on this middle grade novel, which is now still in a closet somewhere. So that's kind of when I started. And Wolf Point didn't have a lot of extra activities that you could do, you know, so it was a pretty quiet place. And as your kids grow up and don't need you as much, and it was kind of one of those creative outlets I found inspiring and encouraging and brought a lot of energy to me. So I started writing then and kind of went from there.
In We Are the Warriors, how about you give a synopsis for listeners to get an idea of the book?
We Are the Warriors was written as a young adult fiction. I've found adults really do enjoy getting into that atmosphere. It's about a young high school student who, at the time, I wasn't living in Bozeman, but he's from Bozeman. He's a snowboarder. Well, his dad gets hired as the principal on this fictitious reservation in southeastern Montana. And so he is basically jerked away from his friends, his snowboarding, his mountains to go out on the prairie and to a culture that he's not familiar with, to a culture he doesn't understand. So the whole trauma of being a junior in high school and having to face this uprooting of your life and your social life and find out who he is in the midst of all of that. Part of my intention of writing it was just to bring people into that kind of a culture, multiculture. I don't think there's any one culture on a reservation or two or three. There's many different cultures, and each person is unique. Each person has a story that brought them to that point in time. And until we learn those stories, do we tend to be able to understand where that person is coming from and their perspective, their worldview, life view. Hopefully within the challenges of this turmoil within the high school, and also some young love and some sadness and some joy and a little bit of the whole sport. Small towns in Montana live on their sports. So there's the whole football element in there, and just basically trying to help people feel what it would like to be in that environment and learn from seeing what was happening, and also invite them into it's not meant to be a certain tribe or a certain group. I debated about whether or not I should go that way. And I thought, I don't feel like it's my right to speak about another tribe. So I did kind of leave it a little bit loose. Some people challenge that perspective, but that's what I chose. And then I set it in southeastern Montana because that's where I grew up. And the sandstone bluffs and the muddy rolling rivers and things like that that were very familiar to me. And the sense of place is really important to me, that people feel that eastern Montana, that they know that they've been there and experienced that. And then also experiencing what 30 years of my life and my children's life on a reservation and going to the schools there and the mix of cultures and what that would be like. And like I say, the microcultures. What are some of the biases that we live with? We all can adapt and learn more, but we all have biases. And how do we adapt and become more than we are?
Blake is the main character. Not only is he a snowboarder, but he's a competitive snowboarder. Yes. And so there's tension because he's leaving Bozeman and all of his friends and everything he's known at the end of the summer, and he goes to southeast Montana with his family, and he's really angry about it.
Yes, he is.
And he's very worried because competitive snowboarding requires a lot of practicing, which we in Bozeman have, but he also has diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
What went into your giving him this complication?
I guess I felt like some young people's lives aren't as simple as we think, and they have challenges, and they might not just be the social challenges. And Blake has this challenge with regulating his blood sugar and being aware of that. And in the ups and downs of teenage life, that's not always the easiest thing to do. And I honestly didn't know a lot about it. I'd known some young teens who did have diabetes, but needed to do my own research, needed to learn a little bit and understand more about. Things have changed, obviously, in the testing methods and stuff since I wrote the book a little. There are some things that people can do differently now, but it's still a challenge. It's still an obvious constant need to monitor and be aware of. And I just felt like, well, this isn't just your average rough and tumble guy. He's got to be aware of other things, too. He can't just be oblivious to that. So it was an important part of his life story was that that was a challenge in his life and other young teens trying to understand what that might be like for him.
I learned quite a bit about living with diabetes from it, but it was an interesting device because he wasn't just some European descendant kid from Bozeman whose dad is the high school principal. I mean, that was also a complication for him.
Definitely. Definitely.
But it was something that whether they were tribal people or non-tribal people in the high school, it was like, oh gosh, he's got to prick himself and he's got to inject. It put him in a different category. A unique category, as far as I could tell, among his peers.
Yeah, and they see him as different anyways. You know, he's a new kid in town and other things about him that they find that are a little bit different. But it's a mix of curiosity and distancing, but there's always that little bit of mix. But a lot of times in small towns, anybody new is interesting. I think it was an opportunity for them to learn about what he was going through when he got to know him a little bit better. I think at first he probably tried to hide it and not try to be different. He wanted to be the same as everybody else, but we all are different from each other. I have had people from Fort Peck, which we short term for the Sioux and Assiniboine Reservation, from Fort Peck, who felt like it really portrayed a lot of what the life and the culture and the microcultures in the area are like, and for good, bad, and indifferent. I mean, we don't have to label it, but it's unique in its own way, but I think people found it very connective, even though this is a Sandstone Bluffs Reservation is a fictitious one in southeast Montana. They could see the connections, and I wasn't trying to typify it like that, but I think it invites people into the story and into learning a lot about reservation life if you've never lived on one. I spent 30 years there. My children grew up and went to school there. So it's an insight. It's an invitation to learn from a different, hopefully a interesting fictional novel perspective. So
your more recent book is Brittle Silver, Teresa Nichols Schuster. Well, let's start with the title. What the heck is brittle silver?
Okay, so brittle silver is a mineral that is one of the several types of silver. Its other name is stephanite, which was a name given from the Archduke of Austria. I believe it has antimony and a sulfide mix in it. It's very fragile as a silver. It breaks easily, and some parts of it can be very lustrous and have like crystals that shine and when they first break open. But then when they're in the daylight and the air for a while, they start to get dusty and all the shine goes away, gets a black cast on it. So it's a very high ore silver, but it's also very fragile. And so it's this mix of, it's, you know, you can see the title is kind of a double entendre in a sense. It's got the brittle silver as an ore, and then brittle silver also typifying that whole silver panic era when the reliance on that just tumbled and what happened to communities and people's lives in that whole situation.
What is your synopsis of the novel Brittle Silver, Teresa Nichols Schuster?
It's set in 1893, mostly during the Great Silver Panic It's a time travel novel, so a young gal, Vic, ends up falling into a mine shaft and comes out 125 years. So she's from the present era. She comes out 125 years into the past, into this mining town of Granite, Montana. So she ends up meeting a young Cornish miner, and when she is pulled out of this hole, they mistake her for a boy. So she's wearing a flannel shirt, jeans, has short hair, thin gal. And realizing the best way for her to survive is to remain, to keep that deception going. So she plays that she's a young guy. So anyways, she gets hired in the mine to work as a mule skinner. Her quest to get home, her quest to understand some of the things that happened there in Granite, because her great-great-grandfather was there and went missing during that time frame. And then also her trying to sort out, she lost her mother from cancer a few years before, and she's just feeling guilty, lost, sad, and really trying to honor whatever her mother might have wanted her to do and also understand and kind of forgive herself for some of the guilt she carries in that whole situation. It's a journey. It's a journey of taking a person back into 1893. So the novel is very highly researched. It's set in Granite and Phillipsburg, Montana. Phillipsburg is still a thriving young old town over there by Andacona and Butte. Granite is now basically a ghost town, ruins, but it's up 7,000 feet in the mountains, about 4 miles out of Phillipsburg. A lot of the research is of what happened at that time, what was going on in the legislatures, in the splitting up counties. The headings in the chapters are actually the mine superintendent's exact words from the letters he wrote back to the St. Louis Company back in 1892 and 93. And the newspaper articles are exact words from the Phillipsburg Mail and other newspapers during that time. So I had a wonderful time researching with the Montana Historical Society, with newspapers, with local historians, and the Granite County Museum was a great help. It was an invitation to, in an adventurous story, invite people into living and feeling and breathing that time in 1892 and 93 when the Silver Panic was building and about to break loose, and a lot of the, around the whole world, the panic hit, banks closed, businesses closed, so it's kind of in the midst of that, and also going into the whole Granite mine and the Ruby Shaft and looking at exactly how that was built, the engines that were used, the buildings, how it was designed. I have maps of, like, Granite, the town. There's 3,200 people living up there in 1892, and churches and school and businesses, saloons. There was a Chinese restaurants, and there was, of course, quote-unquote, women's boarding houses is what the Sanborn fire maps called them. So women of the night, obviously, living there. But very interesting time.
Let's go into the Silver Panic. In a way, it is a huge part of your book, but you don't drown us in it.
I couldn't do that.
Right. But it's important because the fate of the miners rests on the politics and economics of silver. Explain to our listeners a bit more about that. The whole thing about the controversy around free silver coinage and what led to the silver panic.
So it's kind of complicated, and it's not probably one way to answer it. So I even kind of muddle through it when I think about it and process it. But there's a couple of things going on at the same time. They were moving from hand drilling silver to compressed air drills. And so the amount of silver being able to be removed with compressed air versus hand drilling was tremendous. Unfortunately, also, before they learned to put water with it, the dust caused silicosis for a lot of the miners. So the diseases also increased, and it still is issues, but the water was not yet learned to be put on that. So the dust swirling was causing a lot of problems. So anyways, the amount of silver being taken out around the world was going up with the whole steam-powered compressed air drills that was happening around that time. And then also the India mints in India quit buying silver for their mints. And so there was a sudden drop in the purchasing of silver. And then the Sherman Silver Purchase Act required the U.S. to buy a certain amount of silver. I don't know if it was every month. I can't remember exactly how that went. So these things are all kind of going on simultaneously. And then at the same time, there's the economics of free silver coinage was going on. So there was among the populace and groups like miners and some farmers, agricultural people wanted to be able to mint silver at 16 to 1 to gold. So gold is at 1 ounce or whatever, 16. So it was a 16 to 1 gold silver is what they were promoting. And then they wanted to be able to mint the silver as they could do it themselves. So there was this, during that whole election era time, that was a big platform for the populace and what they were working on. And yet silver prices kept dropping and dropping and dropping. So you went from the 1880s to maybe silver at 124 an ounce. And then pretty soon it's down to 90 an ounce. And then it's down to 80 an ounce. So what happens is all these investors are getting nervous and everybody's seeing they put all this money into these towns and mines from Colorado to Argentina to Australia to Montana. And the price is just going down. And so there's this whole instability. Then there's a camp that wants to have the gold standard. They don't want silver in there at all. They want the gold to be our money based on a gold standard. And so it's complicated, and I can't say I totally understand it, and I've totally resonated with all that was going on at the time. But the price of silver during late 1892 and then going into 93 was just like a steady fall. And so the handwriting was on the wall. And not only were the miners going to lose it, but there's all the businesses that were hooked to mining. I mean, there was clothing stores, there's grocery stores, there's restaurants, there's towns. And eventually, banks started closing then in 1893. So all of a sudden, like a bank in Australia would go belly up. It's hard to sometimes sift out all what caused that, but it was like a stair step. Then people get nervous and they want their money out and the banks can't. And then if they've invested in all these mines and they're not getting anything backed on these loans they put out, they don't have the money anymore. So this just became like a tidal wave. And you can feel it coming throughout the novel and even, you know, across the world. You can sense from what was happening that those banks are going up all around the world. And there's runs on banks in Montana. And
was it like the housing crash in 2008 and the global catastrophe that was economically?
Yeah, repercussions. I mean, you think of how much, if you take something and the value has gone from 50% down of what it was, and the banks are all loaned out on that based on that value. And then the mines just start closing, and then all the jobs, people get laid off. And then not only that, but all the support businesses get laid off. And like I was in archives in Anaconda, and I was allowed to look through a lot of stuff. And you realize there's this 1890 to about after World War One, like the 1920, there's this loss of records. And you knew that these towns went shut overnight. Yeah, there was some people hanging on for a little while, but the drop, like the newspaper closed within a week. You have just an upheaval of, and I think it's hard for us to, well, maybe not, but in our recent past, but to imagine such an upheaval where these towns just close overnight and families are struggling, where are they going to go, where are they going to live? And so the silver panic was definitely a panic. I mean, I don't know, you probably could do a lot of research about what happened all around the world. Mine was pretty located just to this area of Montana. It had political ramifications, and it was based on a lot of different things. Like I say, the compressed air drills, India Mint's not buying the silver anymore, that dropped. The price drops from that, and it just stair steps. And when people make a run on a bank and the money isn't there, then that just keeps going.
Yeah, and then the macroeconomic political issues and the tremendous inequality at that time, where the plutocrats wanted the gold standard and the rest of the people wanted the silver.
Yeah.
It's interesting, populism in that era was a very democratic process.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it's morphed in the current era to being almost a fascist movement and very authoritarian, mm-hmm. very restrictive, very shutting people down mm-hmm. for different opinions. It's beyond the scope of our interview to go into that, but it's very helpful, Teresa, that you remind us what populism meant in that era.
Yeah, it was really supportive of the common laborer, of the common worker, in a sense of, you know, kind of a just due for their works and their labors. And it was odd because in the midst of writing this book over, it took me 7 years to finish it, realizing that what was happening in our country at the same time and feeling a little bit, you know, like, oh, it's populist, but, you know, it was a different thing, like you're saying, back then than it is now.
Well, the populism then was truly grassroots. It was organized at very local levels. Mm-hmm. It was also interracial, and the populism of today tends not to be. It has a distinct white supremacist odor to mm-hmm. it. If there is a second main character, it would be Iago. And you had mentioned the Cornish miners. They are generations back miners who immigrated from Cornwall to any number of parts of the United States, but in this case, Granite. And they take great pride in their skills and abilities. They see themselves as essential workers. Iago has conflicts around that. Is that something that you feel comfortable exploring?
Sure. Mining is a difficult job. It's a dangerous job. Mining is something that you go underground and you don't see the sun all day while you're down there. And his family has come out of this Cornish mining background. Cornwall was known for its tin mines and copper mines. And
Roman times.
A long time, yeah. And they did have a drop in that. And so people were leaving Cornwall all over the world. They went from Australia to New Zealand to Montana. South America, they were mining all over. There was a saying that said, wherever there's a hole in the ground, you'll find a Cornishman at the bottom of it. You know, that's a mine. So Iago's got these family backgrounds, but he has dreams of being something else, of doing something else. And he's this 19-year-old Cornish miner, very skilled, very trained with his father, and yet that isn't the life for him, and he has a hard time being able to express that and find a way through that, because miners in those days were paid relatively well. It was dangerous work, but they were making like $4 a day, which was pretty good back then. Back east, they were making $1 or $2 a day, so it was kind of a little bit upper-crust life for that labor movement, really, but he sees himself wanting to be more creative and doing something else than that, and maybe someday get his own store, but he doesn't have kind of the money and the backing that wealthy people might have to do that.
Talk a bit about the whole gender bending thing. That has become such a polarizing political...
Oh, yeah.
Presaged that. It wasn't such a big deal when you were writing this.
No.
But my goodness now...
You look at all the fun stories over the years who have been, you know, the guy pretending to be a gal, the gal pretending to be a guy, getting by doing this, everywhere back from Shakespeare probably and on through. And you think of Yentl years ago, the movie with Barbara Streisand in, and all these fun stories. And I started my novel that way, and here I'm wrapping it up, and I'm thinking, my goodness, we've really kind of turned this into a problem and an issue and focused all eyes on it. And I'm thinking, and there's so many more things we need to be doing for other people and compassion and care for those who are poor, those who have mental health issues, those who need help with this, our world as a whole. And we've focused in on this, and it's like it's intended to be a fun look at life in a different way. And I grew up wandering the riverbanks and wanting to play baseball instead of do what the girls were doing, you know? It's a sad thing that we've polarized ourselves into this situation, and it doesn't have to be in it. But anyways, I hope people can just enter into this story and enjoy it as its face value and the challenges of, yeah, what would it be like to be like this? What would it be like to be like that? And that we always have played with those stories.
Well, what's a steampunk 16-year-old girl from Phillipsburg in contemporary times to do when she finds herself in 1893? I also enjoyed how strange the 1893 guys found her language things. We have so many different cliches, different what you have to learn from one language to another that makes no sense.
Slang and idioms.
Idioms, yeah. That's constantly coming up and threatening to give her away, frankly. It's like, what the heck are you talking about?
Well, and it's funny because as conversations within my writers' groups, we've talked about how you even take the language back and how you would put a sentence together and how you would say things and even maybe some of the diction. I mean, how we would pronounce things. You go back 100 years, and I was watching a rerun of a baseball game, like an all-star game that was in the 70s. There's no way we would have that conversation the same way, and it's only been 40 years, and it was just a baseball game. And I'm like going, they couldn't say that. They wouldn't say that. You would not. And you realize that she has this whole way of speaking that's 125 years different. That is weird. And she's called out for what's that weird thing? And what do you mean there? And she almost wants to slip into using some things from the 21st century that they have no concept of. So she has to catch herself. But she does get kind of looked at. It's kind of, hey, you're kind of strange.
Yeah, and that kept coming up. Doing her best efforts not to, it was still all the time.
And you can imagine after she's there for almost a year, she's going to start to change her language too then.
Those are pretty much the questions that I had for you. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know? Or?
When I first saw the ruins up at Granite, it made me really wonder, you know, where did everybody go? What happened? And that's what really inspired me to get into this story and do the research. And this was a big town at one time. And I think that delving into history helps us to understand what went on, what happened in people's lives. And I just feel like I wrote to help people to kind of step into that. And whether it's the Montana mountains and the hillsides and the streams, or if it's this actual town of Granite, what it was really like at that time, if you went back to 1892 and 93, Phillipsburg, what the streets of Phillipsburg were like, and how some of those buildings still stand in Phillipsburg right now. And just that challenge that people want to do the best they can. They want to support their families. We have a lot of decisions we need to make as human beings on what's the good and the right path. At the same time, to really appreciate people from where they are at that point in time, and whether it's currently now or back in history, that to understand other people is a gift to see their perspectives and also realize that we and them can adapt and become so much more vibrant and aware than we are at the current time and learn from other people too and what's around us.
In researching to prepare for this, I went through a lot of different things. And what continually occurred to me was this was all in a 20-year period, basically, from the first findings of the silver to the disaster of 1893. Mm-hmm. And yet, they built up this incredible town.
Oh, yeah.
And so a lot of it's, you know, using the, at least the foundations were the local granite, but the sheer tonnage of bricks that they brought in, it was on this very steep, I mean, the steepness
narrow.
Of it was crazy.
I mean, the last mile scares me. I mean, last half a mile, I'm petrified because it's like narrow. No way you're going to pass another vehicle. And it's just drop off. And they brought all this iron equipment. They had what, 18 mule driven things to pull this stuff up there. They said they had one spin of cable was 8,000 continuous feet of cable that they brought up there.
8,000?
8,000 continuous feet of cable for the tram.
And also the elevator.
And the shafts too.
The shafts, yeah.
And the cable was this wide and this thin, so it was like a scarf. And there were two of them. And they would go up and down. But the cable, if you ever go to Butte, the mining thing, I think they have one of them there. But to know that this had to be made back east somewhere, brought over on trains to Phillipsburg, and then taken from Phillipsburg 4 miles by horse and mule up there. And all these settling pans they had up there, they didn't make them up there. They had to bring all that stuff. But the skill, too, of the granite, people that would cut the granite and stuff, like, a lot of it might be rough, but then sometimes you'll find where it's perfectly smooth, straight, square for whatever that purpose was of that piece of granite. Maybe I'd compressed air by then they could do some of that with, but still amazing.
Both of your books are self-published, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And are you...
So I kind of think I'm going to get it out myself and do it. I need an editor. I need to have it polished up. So I end up going that route. And I didn't write this as high-end literature. It's not what I call literary fiction. It's historical fiction.
The main character is also 16, but this doesn't seem to be considered a young adult book, although it certainly could be. Is it just too much historical information for that?
I say it's appropriate for ages 12 and over.
Yeah.
And I have had some 12 and 13-year-olds and a 16-year-old who told me how much they enjoyed it and how much they really got into the characters. I think it's, if you set it next to YA fiction, you will see vampires, romance, violence. There's a lot of, just a lot of all that.
It has to be really stimulating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whereas a more quiet teen would appreciate that. And like the one I talked to, well, she got into the characters. She understood them. She really connected with them. So I think
and the situation.
Yes.
I mean, my goodness, what would we do?
Yeah. So there's a type of teen, I think, that would appreciate it, but I tell booksellers to shelve it with adult fiction, but it's appropriate for ages 12 and up. There's nothing in there that 12 and up can't read. It seems to resonate more with folks that enjoy the historical fiction, but I've also found people that like the character development and how that flows and what happens with the character.
And what about the economics of it? You had to put the money up front to publish it, right?
Yeah. Main costs are with editing.
Oh.
So hiring the editor to help me with it is probably the biggest cost, other than my time, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do print on demand, mm-hmm. which is convenient for self-publishing. You only have to buy as many as you want to then, and people can order it on Amazon. I know people cringe at Amazon. Barnes & Noble here in Bozeman has been very supportive. So I've had a good support from them. It's kind of like I told someone, it's a bit like going, buying your boat to go catch trout. You know, you put quite an outlay out for this little fish you get in, you know. So, I mean, it's a little bit discouraging in that mode. But I don't know if last time, something like 1 million books are published a year. Different titles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, and it's more of a regional appeal. So I was kind of excited. The owner of Sapphire Gallery and Candy Store in Phillipsburg is carrying my book over there.
Oh, well.
So,
as well she should.
Yeah, and it's at the Granite County Museum over there. And I think the Bison Bookstore at the Mail has got it too. So kind of keeping it over there for regional.
You know, though, Montana is really hot these days in terms of stories. I've often wondered why that is, as opposed to Colorado or Wyoming or something like that, or even Idaho. But stories seem to get centered in Montana. There's a mystique about that that I don't quite...
It's always been there. It's always been there.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I just think it's kind of that last wide open kind of space, but it's got the mountains and the prairies. It's different than Idaho, and it's different than Montana. It's got the cowboy. It's got... Montana's different than Wyoming and Idaho.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's still... It's got the rolling prairies and the old cowboy mystique and the... Mm-hmm. Also the mountains, and there's just such a variety there. And then there's writers over the years that have written from and within and about Montana, and it's kind of always been there. But it's hard as an independent writer to get it out, because since it's print on demand, the bookstores won't carry it.
Oh.
So like local bookstores in Bozeman and Helena will not put it on their shelf.
Well, can't you just print up a bunch and leave them?
They still have a policy. They won't keep them. They won't take them. Because they're print on demand.
Do you understand the reason from their point of view?
I think they have such small shelf space, and then they either have to wait for you to pick them up, whereas other orders they can send them back.
Yeah.
So that makes it kind of hard. And then, of course, you know, the whole marketing thing is pretty hard to go from an independent standpoint. You don't have all the contacts. You don't have the money. You don't have the backing. So even getting the word out about the novel is difficult. Yeah, it's a pretty slow go self-publishing. Mm-hmm. And even though I strive to have the best novels I can, getting the best editing I can, and spending a lot of time with them polishing and years of writers conferences and writers workshops and all this and that, so I feel good about what I get out there, but it's pretty hard to market it.
Where can listeners who want to read your book, We Are the Warriors or Brittle Silver, how can they go about getting a copy?
So they can get a copy on Amazon. They can get a copy on Barnes & Noble. They can get a copy at local Barnes & Noble in Bozeman. They can get copies in Phillipsburg at various places. If they're interested in wholesale, they can contact me for more quantities via my email. I have a website. It's www.tnschuster.com, and you can find my email address on there and email me if you're...
Say that again slowly.
Contact information, I have a website at www.tnschuster, that's S-C-H-U-S-T-E-R.com, and on there is also my email. And if anybody wants to do wholesale pricing for quantity books, they can get a hold of me through my email. So basically, it's pretty much Amazon and Barnes & Noble in Bozeman is my two favorite go-tos. And then also the Candy Store and Sapphire Gallery in Phillipsburg, and also the Granite Museum there in Phillipsburg.
Anything else you want to add?
Not that I can think of right now, but it's been wonderful to visit with you, Joy, and so nice to share some of my writing journey and life journey and love of Montana and the rolling hills and the mountains.
Well, Teresa Nichols-Schuster, thank you so much for joining us today on Echo Times. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
So glad I could be here today. Thank you so much, Joy. Appreciate it.
You have just heard a conversation with Bozeman author Teresa Nichols-Schuster about her books, We Are the Warriors and Brittle Silver. You can find her books at Barnes & Noble here in Bozeman, Wheatgrass Books in Livingston, and the House of Books in Billings, or Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. And you can find out more or contact Teresa Nichols Schuster at her website, tnschuster.com. That's tnschuster.com. Echo Tones is a Beyond the Deep End production, hosted and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, and Forthright.media. We thank you for listening and for your support. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire, signing out for now.